Scott Weinberg is a veteran film critic. Steven DeGennaro is a doctor of astrophysics. Listen in as these two nerds compare and contrast two noteworthy sci-fi films every week. They'll discuss the artistic quality of the films, whether they get the science right, and whether or not that even matters. Welcome to Science vs. Fiction.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Science vs. Fiction. My name is film critic Scott Weinberg, and I am joined by my good friend, Dr. Steven DeGennaro, who is a doctor of astrophysics, which means he knows everything about the Jetsons dog.
And also the zodiac signs.
You are an astrologer of, of very strong repute, and I would love you to tell me what it means. What's my horoscope for today? I'm a Capricorn.
You're going to die.
No! It's 53 minutes left in the day. So if I don't die in the next 53 minutes...
Oh, I didn't say today. I said you're going to die.
Oh, well, we all are, sir.
Well, that about sums up how horoscopes work. Tell something that's going to be true for everybody, and then people go, wow, I can't believe that's true.
A person you've never met will have an influence on your life. Wait a minute, that guy dinged my car in the parking lot. Whoa. Yep. We are here today to discuss two very different sci-fi films that I think have some connecting DNA in a way that Steven wasn't aware of at the beginning, but I think he may now. Let's talk about Minority Report and Logan's Run, two seminal or very well-known science fiction films, I think very well-regarded in most respects. For my money, Minority Report might be Spielberg's best, like, mid or late career film. I think it's most of the Spielberg films I love the most were of the 70s and the 80s, but this I would put probably in his top 10. I love Minority Report, and man, it really holds up. It's the perfect combination of a really clever premise. Thank you, Philip K. Dick, and screenwriter Scott Frank. A really clever premise, and then built with a great cast, a great look, a really brilliant editorial approach. So the movie moves at an urgent pace. There's good action. It films like a noir. It plays like a mystery. There's some tragedy in it. It's just great. I think it hits on all cylinders. And I'd like to know what Steven thinks about it.
You're right. I did not see what the similarity of these two movies were before watching them both this week. I mean, I'd seen Minority Report. I had never seen Logan's Run before, and I'm very much looking forward to our discussion on that. But they have almost no scientific DNA in common, but they have oddly similar plot mechanics in that they are both about a dude who is a member of an oppressive system that then turns against them, forcing them to go on the run, and in both cases with a female companion. And then they each discover that the system that they were formerly a part of is built on a lie, and they decide to return in order to expose the corruption at the heart of the system.
Yeah. And so that's exactly right. That is exactly what I was going for. And one sub-theme that I'm sure you also have in your head is that he was fine being part of the corrupt system until he was personally targeted.
Yep.
And then that's what it created, you know, empathy and humanity. Because once you're targeted personally, then you are forced to feel, you know, outside the system. You are forced to empathize with the least powerful in the world.
Yep.
And that's my favorite thing about it is, like, in the first 20 minutes of each movie, both protagonists are interesting but kind of jerks. And then they get, you know, once they find their humanity and they find a reason to once they are personally targeted and have to go on the run from the system that they formerly venerated or at least respected. And I think that's a fascinating theme in sci-fi, you know, just.
So, let's do a quick plot summary for those who have not seen Minority Report before.
All you, man.
Well, it is about a police officer played by Tom Cruise who runs a division called Pre-Crime, in which three psychics are used in order to determine that somebody is going to commit a murder before they actually commit the murder, and they can then stop the murder from happening and put the person into this weird sort of limbo jail. And it brings up, you know, it immediately brings up this question of, well, if you stop them from doing it, then they didn't do it. And so how can you punish them for doing it?
Right. Oh, what a great book. And then the idea is that, well, we've made laws. Like, in you know, in the laws that you and I live in now, Stephen, they could never do that. But if you change the Declaration or you change the Bill of Rights and all of a sudden it's, oh, well, now you can arrest somebody for this thought of that I'm about to murder someone.
Well, see, but it's not just a thought. That's the interesting thing about it. I mean, you could posit that it's sort of a thought crime, but it is, I think, one of the most brilliant moments in this movie is when Tom Cruise is trying to explain this to Colin Farrell. So Colin Farrell plays like a federal agent who comes in to sort of see how this pre-crime thing works. And Tom Cruise explains to him, he throws this ball down the length of a table.
Yeah, he rolls it across the long desk.
Right, and then it falls off the end of the desk and Colin Farrell grabs it before it hits the ground. And he said, well, why did you grab it? He said, well, because it was going to hit the ground. But you stopped it from hitting the ground. Well, yeah, but it was going to hit the ground if I didn't stop it. And so that was his explanation of what pre-crime is.
Right, and both of those things are true.
Yes. That, to me, is a very Spielbergian kind of thing. Like that, rather than having a character just explain this to the other character, I'm going to show it to you in a very sort of visual way.
Yep.
Here's the visual of exactly what we're talking about. Just because you stop something from happening doesn't mean that it wasn't going to happen.
Oh, totally. And he's brilliant at that. Imagine how he did it in Jurassic Park with the little film strip, you know? It's like he's always been really good at giving the movies major hooks and visualizing them. Yep. That's a good call.
So, so you know, the way this system works, these three psychics who are psychics is maybe even not the right word. They're called precogs.
Empaths.
They are human in form, but it's an open question at the beginning of the movie whether they are actually human in any way. And they apparently can see this crime beforehand, and this computer reads out the images in their brain, which I'm gonna we'll love to talk about that technology in a little bit. And then it tells them who is gonna get killed and who's gonna kill them and when it's gonna happen. And it's Tom Cruise's job to sort through these images and figure out where this person is and, you know, be able to stop the crime in time. And again, in this flurry of visual exposition that's also tense and scary and interesting, that, you know, the opening sequence is him trying to solve what they call a red ball, which is a crime of passion, because nobody premeditates murder anymore because they know that the minute that they try to plan it, they'll just get arrested for planning.
The more you talk about it, the more I am impressed by the layers of cleverness in this, not in this original story and in the screenplay. It's like if you're turned on by like just clever ideas that are illustrated in a fun story, this movie's got dozens of like interesting ideas.
Yeah.
And then of course, without giving away the entire plot, the Tom Cruise character, Chief John Anderton, is suspected. The precogs say, bing, bing, you're about to murder somebody. And Tom Cruise has no idea who the potential victim is, and then he has to go on the run from the very system that he helped build. And then Neil McDonough, his former colleague, is on the chase after him, and Colin Farrell, who is the federal agent. Then he also briefly teams up with one of the empaths, played brilliantly by Samantha Morton. There's Max von Sydow. There's so many good people in this movie.
Yeah, no, that's one of the things that I want to talk about most. That's fascinating to me. We touched on this a little bit when we talked about closed loop time travel in our Time After Time episode. But the events of this story are set in motion by his name coming down on this little red ball. What they call it, the red ball. And the name of this victim, Leo Crow, I think was it?
Yep.
Coming down as the victim's name and him seeing himself shooting this person in the images that the precogs are putting out. And that, you know, he immediately realizes, you know, with very quick thinking, oh crap, I need to get out of here before anybody figures this out, he, you know, goes on the run. But this only happens because the precogs predict it. And if the precogs hadn't predicted it, he never would have gone on this journey to eventually kill this person.
And therein lies one of the most beautiful dilemmas or quandaries of science fiction that we just love. You know, it's like, wait, but it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Yep. If they hadn't made the prediction, the event wouldn't have happened.
Yep, exactly. And to me, again, it feels a lot like a closed loop time travel story in that way, where like you can have, you know, where if Kyle Reese hadn't come back chasing the Terminator, then Skynet never would have arose and sent a Terminator back.
Right. And these are things that cannot be reconciled. It doesn't matter how clever or smart you are as a screenwriter. It's literally impossible. That's the beauty of science fiction. It's not.
Well, but it's also, it doesn't need to be reconciled because it is self-consistent entirely, you know, in its own sort of thing. But in this movie in particular, it obviously foregrounds this question of free will, which is, you know, at the heart of so much of Philip K. Dick's stuff, and especially this movie, is this idea that, you know, do you have a choice? And he has, you know, so he's, you know, then set off on this journey, which includes a lot of chasing and Tom Cruise running, of course, because it's a Tom Cruise movie. And he eventually ends up in this place where he meets this person that he's supposed to have decided to kill. long before he ever, right.
I like the switching of tense there.
Yeah.
Well done.
There's a bit in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy where they talk about the different tenses you have to use in time travel. But it's a similar sort of thing here, right? So he finally meets this guy that he is supposed to have wanted to kill from before he ever met him, and learns that this guy, or thinks that he learns that this guy is the person responsible for kidnapping his son years and years earlier. Which, can we talk about that a little bit too?
Absolutely.
We've talked about, in this podcast a lot, I have talked about how a lot of times for me, whether or not something clicks or not is how well I click with the main character, or any of the characters, but particularly the main character. And this it was starkly brought home to me because I saw this movie in the theater when it came out in 2002, and I enjoyed it. It was clever. It was well made. It's, you know, a taut thriller, and it has some good twists and turns, and I remember enjoying it a lot, but not being particularly sort of necessarily touched or moved by it in any particular way. This time through, and we've also talked numerous times about how, as a parent, the whole tragic backstory, person's got a dead kid. We just did this last week, didn't we? In when we were talking about Stargate.
Yeah.
And how it doesn't work in that movie at all because it's tacked on and it's literally just there to sort of like give you some sort of reason to feel for that character.
Yeah, it's very clunky writing, yes.
In this movie, it is absolutely organic to the story. It's organic to what's going on. It feels like it belongs thematically. It feels like it belongs, like it becomes really important in the story. It's literally the only thing. And he says this. He says, you know, you figured out the only thing that could make me actually kill somebody, which is killing the guy that he thought was responsible for his son's death. And the fact that John Anderton, who that character is, that is the only thing that would ever make him commit homicide. And so that becomes not only integral to the plot, but it also, again, from a thematic point of view of like, of, you know, it's woven into the story in a way.
Oh no, you're absolutely right. It is, just from a storytelling point of view, it is in no way just, oh, his kid died, so feel bad for him. That is a small part of it, because that's a tragedy that nobody should, you know, that's the worst tragedy in the world. But it informs the character. It's a crucial plot element.
But then it also then comes, it becomes important thematically, you know, so he kidnaps, so to speak, the precog and takes her on this journey because he needs to find out what's in her mind. And through that, you know, he learns her backstory, which is that she was the daughter of this woman who, you know, and was taken away from her. And because she had these abilities as a precog, she was kept away from her. And, you know, spoiler alert, we learn at the end of the movie that Max von Sydow killed her mother in order to keep her from getting the daughter back. It defines his character. It's the reason why he became a police officer and why he believes so fervently in pre-crime. And you have this idea of the father and mother of pre-crime, quote, and you have this idea of, you know, Max von Sydow as something of a father figure to Tom Cruise. So it's woven all the way throughout this whole thing about parenthood, about losing people. It isn't a dead kid trope because it's so important to the story.
Yeah, I mean, there's like film critic cliches that like there's not a wasted frame. Well, in this script, there's not a wasted syllable or idea. There's never just, oh, look at this. This is kind of funny. Like, oh, these advertisements, aren't they cool? No, they serve a plot point. They're now like tracking him. That sequence where he is walking through that mall with her, she is so great in this movie. I mean, like, she's not just like jittery and vulnerable, but at moments where she's supposed to be really smart or really scared or really, oh, Samantha Moore, I think she was nominated for this, actually. Off the top of my head, I don't remember, but I wouldn't be surprised if she was. Also, Jessica Harper pops up, Tim Blake Nelson.
Oh, I love Tim Blake Nelson.
Peter Stormare as the weirdo doctor in a sequence that could just be enjoyed just as its own dark sci-fi, like, short.
So, yeah, you talked about not a wasted frame. Watching the movie this time, that whole sequence felt kind of tacked on to me, to be completely honest.
A bit, maybe a little floor, a little bit excessive. Okay, fair enough.
It was just, you know, well, from a purely plot point, it ends up being almost entirely unnecessary. Like the whole point of that sequence is he's on the run. They can, you know, his eyes can be scanned, you know, by as he's walking through the mall or wherever. Like,
right,
that's how this,
right,
this society identifies people. And so he needs to have his eyes changed and has to have new eyes transplanted so that his eyes won't give him away. But then what's the very first thing that he does after he gets his eyes changed? He goes back to the pre-crime facility and uses his old eyes to get himself into the facility. And then he, you know, uses this thing that makes his face go all floppy like a hound dog, supposedly to disguise him, but he uses his own eyes to get in. They know immediately that it's him. And so like that, you could cut that entire sequence out and just have him just go back there, you know.
Right. Or if you, I mean, there's a lot of glitz in there, like a lot of extra glitz and gee-whizzery in that sequence, where if the plot point is he had his eyes surgically removed, it could be a third that length. You could get,
yeah,
you know,
and then there's this kind of slapstick, like, oh, he ate the rotten sandwich and chased it with the spoiled milk. It just felt like that's the, you know, attempt at this broad comedy. That's
Spielberg. You know, it's like, because he realizes that scene is among the darkest in the movie, so he needs to lighten it up with some kind of humor.
I will say, the ending of that sequence where they have the little spider things go through the...
The overhead shot?
Yeah, and the overhead shot. And, you know, the idea of that is really, really cool, and the way that it's shot is masterful. And so, like, I guess that alone is justifies that sequence being in there and him trying to hide under the ice. And then he comes back up, and he's, like, has to pull the thing up to so that thing can scan his eye, and it's just, it's creepy and weird. And
also I love the theme there, that these are these super high tech, you know, let's call them spider probes, can scan an entire apartment building, but technology can still be easily beaten, because it does. If a human had walked in, they would have caught him, but because they're using this technology, he was able to cheat it.
He was able to cheat it, though, because he had his eyes transplanted.
Yeah.
Now, there's some, you know, there's some medical foo-foo going on there. Like, it's hard to imagine any technology that could allow you to actually swap out eyes and reconnect your optic nerve in a way that would work. But it is literally impossible to imagine being able to do that, and then like 2 days later, like, you can just see.
Like, right. Plus that droopy dog technology is also a little bit goofy, if I'm being honest.
Yes. I mean, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but you could, whatever. But the eye thing to me is like, it's fascinating, because the closest thing that we have currently to something technology like this would be something like cochlear implants, which are, you know, they stick a bunch of, simplifying a bit, but they stick a bunch of wires into the ear canal of a deaf person, and then they have what is basically a microphone that attaches on the outside of their head, and that microphone then translates sounds into electrical signals and fire these little pins that are in their cochlear nerve. I think I may have that term wrong, but the point being, you know, it's for people whose eardrums don't work. Their physical hearing mechanism doesn't work.
It's a miniature series of telegraphs on your eardrum.
Right. But it's not like a hearing aid where, like, you take the sound and then you just amplify it so somebody can hear it a little bit louder.
No, you're bypassing, like you said, you're finding a detour to the oral right. implant. To the
and,
oral.
And so you're translating it directly into electrical signals that then go directly into the person's brain. Now, for those things to work, like, they have to be trained. Like, when you turn a cochlear implant on, and you can find YouTube videos of this, it's amazing to watch. People, they can hear immediately, but they can't make sense necessarily of what it is they're hearing until they've had a whole lot of practice. It's basically like, you know, how you had to learn to hear when you were a little baby, or how you had to learn to see when you were a little baby. Like, you look at
right.
something.
Or imagine if you were able to see after 35 years, you would right. be overwhelmed. You'd need context and time to parse out what you're literally
right.
seeing.
And if you got somebody else's eyes transplanted into your head, and now leaving aside for the moment the, you know, the medical aspect of, you know, worries about infection, worries about, you know, your eyes would probably be swollen shut. It would take weeks probably before you actually just physically healed from the inflammation and trauma that would have caused to your eyes. But even if you, you know, you can imagine that there are some futuristic drugs that they're able to use to get bypass that. What is harder to imagine they can bypass, again, is that wherever these eyes came from, this person's optic nerves are not going to be wired the same way as your optic nerves were. And so your brain is going to have to basically relearn how to see.
Right. It's not exactly the same as maybe a finger.
Right. I mean, like, you, well, even fingers. Like, if you put a finger, you know, this is a thing that also has to happen. Like, if people have strokes, people have nerve damage, you know, and they have to relearn how to walk, right? These are things that happen fairly commonly in our world. And your brain is a really complex and a fascinating machine, but it does so much interpreting. Like, when you see something, you know that, like, you know, I'm looking at this microphone right now, and whatever angle I look at this microphone from, I recognize it as a microphone. And if you try to tell a computer to do that, we're just now kind of getting to a place where you can kind of have a computer reliably identify certain things. But the human brain, like, you spent years training going, okay, that thing is a phone, that thing is a microphone, that thing is a pair of glasses, that is a computer, that's a speaker, and you can look at that and you can immediately recognize what that is because your brain has all these pattern recognition algorithms essentially programmed into it. So, like, my point is that we tend to think of our senses as these things that, as this passive experience where, like, I, you know, light from the world hits my eyes and then I know what that thing is. But your brain is doing a whole lot of interpolating and pattern recognition and figuring out what a thing is so that you know what it is. It's not just a matter of just seeing it. It's one of the reasons why you can be fooled. Like, you wake up in the middle of the night and you look over and you think there's somebody in your room.
That's never happened to me ever.
And then you flip the light on and you realize it's a pile of clothes sitting on your thing that kind of vaguely looked like a person.
Okay, that has.
And so, you know, but it's because your brain goes, that's a person, that's a person. Before, you know, your conscious mind is even necessarily aware of the fact that you're misinterpreting some sort of sensory data.
So essentially what you're saying is the eyeball transplant in the dirty hotel room wouldn't work.
I mean, it's hard to imagine. It could work. I think an eyeball transplant could work.
We've spent a lot of time on the eyeball thing.
But I think it would take months of healing and rehabilitation and stuff.
I'd like to spend a little more time discussing the pre-crime concept because, as I know, and our listeners might not, you are not only an astrophysicist, but you've also studied philosophy. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, for two things that seem opposed, they're often not. They're both deals with speculation. Yeah. They both deal with, you know, some in a hard way and some in a more thoughtful and pensive and meditative way. But the philosophy that is peppered throughout this movie, the very idea of the rolling the ball across the desk, and if I had, well, then, you know, it would be an interesting extrapolation or an extension of that scene. What if he dropped it? How would the scene have played out different?
Yeah.
What if he hadn't let it go?
Yeah. Well, but that, again, that's a beautiful piece of exposition because Tom Cruise's character knows that he's going to catch it. So there is, even in that, you know, it's sold in the moment as this deterministic thing of, like, okay, gravity works on this ball. The ball will fall and it will eventually hit the ground unless something stops it. But there's some psychological stuff in there as well because Tom Cruise knows.
Yeah, what I know about this human being, what I know about most humans and this human in particular tells me he will definitely catch this ball.
And so it's never foregrounded in that scene, but it also raises the question, did Colin Farrell have the free will to let that thing fall, or was his decision determined in some way? Yeah.
Yeah, good question. It's really, and that is the yin and the yang of science fiction combined with philosophy, which is the nature of human behavior, you know? Like, what does it say about a person who would have just let it fall and went, why'd you do that? Like, any human you know would catch that ball. Why is that in our nature? To stop chaos, you know, to prevent chaos.
So let's talk about some of the other scientific things in here. And,
I
think we should go through them fairly quick because some of them I don't think deserve super in-depth treatments like eye transplants do.
How about the completely automated car manufacturing facility?
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah,
love
I mean
it.
That's I don't know that much about auto manufacturing, but I imagine that there's a lot of that. You know, it's not completely automated these days, but it's, you know, there's a whole lot of automation in manufacturing, especially in America.
Could you see the producers and the you know, sitting around everybody and the writers going, all right, we want to have an elaborate, you know, when the chips finally fall and Anderton has to fight back against his colleagues, where do we have this all take place? And then someone's like, you know, throw out a dozen ideas and it's like an automated car factory. That's cool. Let's do that.
We've talked about this, I think, on the podcast before, but one of the I don't want to say rules of science fiction, but it's certainly one of the guiding principles of a lot of science fiction is you take our world and then you change one thing. You know, you either make it so that there's genetic engineering or you make it so that there's, you know,
mutants.
Super fast computers or whatever it is. Because the more you pile one thing on top of another, the harder it gets to suspend your disbelief when you're watching it. And this movie is kind of exhibit A in the exception to the rule in that regard, because there are so many bits of futuristic technology in here. You've got the cars that, you know, move, the self-driving cars that climb up and down buildings. You've got the six sticks, which I think are really interesting. They, you know, rather than having tasers, they have sticks that when you poke somebody with it, it makes them vomit uncontrollably. You have jetpacks. You have plants that have been genetically engineered to be able to move and administer poison to intruders.
As like a security fence or something.
Right. You have the precogs, obviously, and the whole idea of pre-crime. You have the personalized ads, which, you know, watching this movie, I was struck by they seem about as accurate as online personalized ads are today. Like none of the stuff that they seem to be hawking to him as he's walking through this mall seemed like things that he would be remotely interested in.
That is kind of a sly joke. I never even noticed that before, but that might be a sly joke. And what I love about this is so many futuristic films made 10, 15, 20 years ago have these little touches and you're like, yeah, nice try, but that's really out of date by now.
Yeah.
It's really not realistic by now looking back. But those ads seem very realistic. That's prescient. I mean, there's some really, that's a smart piece of production design, you know?
Well, and speaking of things that don't seem like they panned out, there's like the video newspapers. The guy's reading a newspaper and it's like, you know, it looks like a newspaper, but it has, you know, the headline updates and whatever else. Like nowadays, obviously, if you're sitting on a train reading an interactive newspaper, it would be an iPad, you know, or your phone.
No, I got this giant virtual newspaper. But yeah, some things are just created for, you know, visual flair, and that's so much fun. Yeah. And again, the movie takes place in 2054. So it's not like it's like 2600 or something, you know?
So one of the questions that I had about the movie that, you know, I don't think came up for me the first time I saw this movie, but did this time. They spend so much of the movie, they meaning Danny Whitwer, played by Colin Farrell, and Neil McDonough and various other people, you know, the pre-crime division, you know, the whole premise of this movie is that they're trying to find Tom Cruise in order to stop him from becoming a murderer. And so they spend all this time chasing him, looking for him, instead of doing what Tom Cruise spends the first 15 minutes of the movie doing, which is looking through all of the footage to figure out where and when the murder is going to happen, and then just being there when it happens. And it was weird to me that they didn't just do that. It's like, okay, well, they can do literally what Tom Cruise, but maybe they're not as good at it as Tom Cruise was. Maybe that's why he's the best, because he can put together these, you know, little bits of information. But they have like 2 days or whatever to figure out where, you know, what hotel room is this taking place in, and then let's just go there. Who is this person that he's going to kill? Who's Leo Crow? How can they not track, or why are they do not seem to be trying to track him down to figure out where he's going to be at the appointed moment of the murder? But then we get to the point of the murder, and it's a very clever twist. You know, the whole driving force of this first half of the movie is that he was trying to find the Minority Report. So the mother of pre-crime tells him that occasionally all three precogs don't agree with one another. And one of them, you know, two of them agree, and one of them, usually Agatha, played by Samantha Morton, is the one that disagrees, which is why he's trying to download her brain. And then he learns that, no, she also agreed that he was going to kill this guy. And so he ends up in this place, in this situation that she foresaw, and she's telling him basically, you know your future so you can change it. And we, you know, we're wondering whether or not he's going to kill him, and then he decides not to. And it's an amazing little moment, I think, because he really, really wants to, and you don't know whether he's going to or not. And he ultimately decides to do the right thing and decides to arrest him. And then the guy grabs his gun and shoots himself and falls out the window in a way that is still exactly as she had predicted it. And so, you know, it still looks like he killed him. I don't know. There's so much clever plotting in this movie.
One of the scientific things that I thought was cool is this was not the first, but one of the first movies to use that virtual menu swipe technology and use it well.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know that many films used it before that. And just being able to like call it up and have Tom Cruise be doing that all swipey stuff.
No, it was cool.
And make it look real. Yeah. That sells the technology. Yeah. And it just adds another layer of cool to instead of him just typing away or something,
right.
You know.
It does still have that same problem that we've pointed out a couple times before where you can see through the screen. And that makes, you know, like you can see
right.
What's in the wall behind the screen, and there's not really much of an advantage to that.
Right.
That I can see.
If the monitor I was looking at could see the wall behind me, right?
Right. It would just make it harder to see things on your monitor. And the other thing that I love about the plotting of this movie is the moment where Max von Sydow is revealed as the bad guy in the movie by killing Colin Farrell. And he's like, you know, he's only able to do that because the precogs are effectively blind at that moment because Tom Cruise has stolen one of them. And then a couple scenes later, the wife figures it out And you can see this amazing moment of acting from Von Sydow where, like, he considers killing her. He knows he has to because she knows the secret now, but then he knows that he can't because now the precogs are all back in their thing and it would
hoisted by his own precogs.
But it's an interesting moment, right?
Oh, it's great.
Because again, it brings up that whole question of free will because, like, he, you know, if he thought hard enough about killing her, would that set them off or would he, like, I don't think it would. Like, they would have to actually see that he was going to do it. And so he, because he knows the precogs are there and because he knows how they work, he has this weird sort of advantage over, like, any other character in that position would have realized they had to kill her and in that moment would have probably set the precogs off because they would have planned to do so. But he knows that he can't plan to do so. And so he doesn't plan to do so. It's weird. It blows you. It makes your head hurt if you think about it too much.
Yeah. One thing that we have to get into real quick is that the ending of the film is sometimes criticized for being either a kind of a cheat, too happy, too light of an ending, or maybe, God forbid, and it was all a dream in his head kind of throwaway. Mm-hmm. I think, personally, that Spielberg and the writers get the ambiguity. You can interpret it how you like. It could be construed as a relatively happy ending, or it could be construed as a cautionary tale that all took place in the head of somebody unconscious.
Wait, what? I missed that.
Okay, I'm going to quote from Wikipedia.
Because, like, that he while he's sleeping in the chamber.
Yeah, no. I'm going to quote from the Wikipedia article real quick. Huh. The most commonly criticized element of the film is its ending. The film has a more traditional happy ending, which contradicts the tone of the rest of the picture. This has led to speculation that this ending is the product of John's imagination caused by hallucinations from his forced coma after he is incarcerated.
All right. Yeah, I don't agree with that at all. Number one, clearly whoever wrote that has never seen a Spielberg movie before.
Well, no, that's not entirely fair because one of the complaints against Spielberg is that he always has to end on something uplifting, whether or not it feels artificial or not.
I don't think this ending is uplifting. I don't, like, I really don't. I think it's, and I also, furthermore, I think that it's the perfect ending from this movie. I was struck by it, especially this time through, how, again, it absolutely is of a piece with the theme of the entire thing because at the climax of this movie, Max von Sydow decides to kill Tom Cruise. The pre-crime people see that it's going to happen. They, you know, start trying to, you know, stop him from doing so. And Tom Cruise is like, mimics what Agatha said to him earlier in the movie, which is, you know your future, you can change it. And, you know, and he's put to this amazing dilemma, Max von Sydow is. So, you know, Tom Cruise is like, well, you can kill me, you know, and then you get haloed into this fate worse than death, or you could not kill me. And if you don't kill me, then it means that you had a choice to not kill me, which would mean that the precogs were wrong for having predicted it. And that then, of course, in turn implies that all of the other people that they have now imprisoned in this, you know, that they've haloed over the years had a choice not to commit their crimes. So either he, you know, Max von Sydow either goes to jail for the rest of his life or he destroys this system that he built up over many, many years. And it's a really interesting dilemma that he finds in. And I think it's very much of a piece with the themes of the entire thing. I don't think that there's another way that you could end this movie that would be as satisfying.
Yeah, I agree. I just remember when it came out about a year and a half later, that one of the biggest complaints about the movie was that the ending felt like a throwaway or maybe possibly a dream ending or just cheap or you know, not as maybe just too hopeful considering the rest of the film.
I
like the ending. I like it.
Yeah. So my last little bit here, I think some good old-fashioned police work might have kept the whole story from happening. So ultimately the story is about Max von Sydow had tricked the system, which again I think is a brilliant way that he did this, where he hired somebody to kill Agatha's mother.
Mm-hmm.
The pre-crime people came and stopped that from happening. And then he went and killed Agatha's mother in the exact same way that guy was going to have done it. And the precogs saw it again, but the technicians, you know, assumed that it was just an after echo
an
or
echo.
Whatever.
Yep.
And so they discarded, you know, they disregarded it. And so he was able to do it, able to get away with it.
And it's how white collar criminals know how to rig a system because they helped build it,
right.
You know?
But the only reason why this works, right, this it raises an interesting question, which is if you hire somebody to kill somebody, apparently the precogs don't see that part of it. right? Because the precogs only thought that this guy was trying to kill him.
Yeah, that would be the that would be the loophole. If there was a Minority Report sequel, you could say that the idea would be, since murder is now completely catchable, preventable, or let's say 98% preventable, there is now a market for the ultra elite killers. And these are who are hired to be able to pull it off. And you'd have to have these ultra brilliant assassins, because how would you be able to cheat the system? You'd have to.
Right. But even in the case of, again, like if just a garden variety, like I hired somebody to kill my wife, not knowing that pre-crime existed or believing that I wouldn't get caught or whatever, and then they come and they catch the person in the act of trying to kill my wife. Like in the movie, they halo the people immediately. They put the head thing on them, and then they stick them in this, you know, vegetable jail, whatever you want to call it.
Vegetable jail works.
But, you know, they should have interrogated that guy.
Like,
it's like they didn't even bother to like then go back and be like, okay, well, why was he trying to kill him? What was his motive?
He could have been blackmailed. What Maybe somebody said, kill your wife or I'll kill 10 people.
Right. Or he could have been hired to do it he was. And so it seems like, you know, like they would want to at least interrogate the person and be like, hey, why are you trying to kill this person?
Is the implication that he's instantly and perpetually haloed or maybe temporarily until they can interrogate him? Or
no, I mean, because they're all stored in that place.
They can interrogate him while he's under.
But they don't. Like they're all stored in Tim Blake Nelson's vault. And he just plays organ for them. And
I think you mean vegetable prison.
Right, the vegetable prison. Speaking of the vegetable prison, one of the other things that doesn't quite make sense is that when Tom Cruise comes looking for the person who killed Agatha's mom, Tim Blake Nelson tells him, oh yeah, that was this John Doe over here. But the entire apparatus of this thing is built around these two balls getting carved with names on them, with the name of the killer and the name of the victim. So how was there ever a John Doe? Did the ball say John Doe?
The implication could be that they're fallible and that they caught the crime but weren't able to tell who it was, you know.
I mean, possibly, I guess. But again, like it feels like if you're the police, you would want to like backtrace, okay, who is this person? Why did they decide to kill this woman? What was, you know, like knowing that seems important information to stop other plain old garden variety crimes.
Well, you know, it also leads into the whole thematic idea, which is, hey, these people now have a system in which they can catch murderers before they do it. And that leads to them not caring about interrogation and due course. And they just don't care. Yeah. The guy is now in the vegetable prison. Ha ha. We win. Yeah. That could be like, it's just that the system now cares exponentially less about the human right.
Yeah, but it feels a little bit like a screenwriter cheat of like, okay, well, if we just have them put people in regular jail, then Tom Cruise could go and like talk to the guy, and that
which is precisely what he does when he visits vegetable prison,
basically.
Did we cover the rocket packs?
We mentioned them. I don't think we need they're rocket packs.
How far are we away from that technology, Steve?
I mean, we have something like that now. The problem with rocket packs is fuel. Like they're like water jet packs where like there's an actual hose going from a lake into the thing, and then you know it shoots you up into the air. You know, an actual jet pack would not be able to carry enough fuel to keep you aloft for more than a few seconds.
Right.
You know, a minute, a couple minutes maybe.
Since we're going to do this before we move on to our final judgments, what kind of technology would be involved in making the six sticks work?
Oh, I have no idea. It's interesting.
Right? I zap you with this and you vomit. What is the zap doing to you? It's affecting your gag reflex or you're convulsing your stomach in some way.
Well, in the movie, he hits him in the neck and it's, you know, I don't know if that's required or if that just happens to be where Tom Cruise has the stick pointed.
It's a great way to incapacitate someone. It's such a good idea.
No, it is. I would imagine if it, like you said, maybe it does activate the gag reflex through some sort of electrical stimulation or... It's got to be some sort of nerve thing, I would imagine, that, you know, the other possibility is that it gives you severe motion sickness. It does something to your inner ear to where you suddenly feel like you're spinning.
Right. Exactly. It might not even be belly related. It might be inner ear related. It just makes you totally dizzy.
Yeah.
All right. So wrapping up, I love this movie. I think that it has a lot of fanciful science, but it seems like the writers and the technical people were invested in making it seem at least as realistic as possible because it feels very futuristic, but also of the past in a way. I absolutely love this movie. I think it's one of Spielberg's best of the entire decade, was 90s. And this is the decade when he did like AI and Catch Me If You Can. And I love Spielberg. And I think this is... again, one of his top 10, endlessly entertaining, smart. It gets an A for me on all counts.
It's an A, definitely. I probably would have said A- or B+ prior to this viewing. And again, that just goes to show sort of, I think, how the personal angle of it, the dead son thing just really hit me in a way this time.
Could it be, is it just that simple, Stephen, that when you saw it, you were impressed as a movie nerd, but now being a father a little boy, you're like, well, now it just got me right in my personal gut.
That's exactly what I'm saying. That I, you know, when I, in 2002, when this came out, I was 25 years old. Had no kids, you know. I was still years away from having kids. Now that I have two of them, you know, especially the little boy who's just a little bit younger than the boy in this movie. That moment at the pool, you know, the flashback where he loses him, is truly, like, for a parent, is one of the, like, there's not a single parent alive who hasn't had that moment happen, where you have your kid and then you turn around and they're not there, and for a few seconds you're just like, holy crap, where's my kid? And, you know, 99.999% of the time they're hiding behind something, or you just, like, half the time, is, you know, they're literally right behind you and you just, like, look over the top of their head because you don't see them. You know, but there's always, you know, every single parent has had that moment, you know, multiple times in their life. And just that feeling of, like, you know, that feeling that he, you know, that you can see him go through that, okay, he's got to just be around here somewhere, and then realizing that he's not, and then realizing that this is actually a serious thing, like, is every parent's worst nightmare, and it's beautifully executed.
Yeah, it's a horrifying scene, and that's one thing I will always say throughout Spielberg's career. He has been able to get across horror in very quiet and sometimes subtle ways.
So, yeah, so an A for me for entertainment value, and, you know, I'd probably give it a B for science. It's one of those movies that is just sort of enough out there, in terms of, you know, distance from our own actual world, that a lot of the science gets a pass, but it doesn't really need one. You know, aside from the eye thing, there's very little in this thing that really makes me go, okay, well, I'm bothered by something that I don't understand how it happens.
Yeah, I don't buy that we're going to have this technology in 2054, but it is also, it's fanciful and gee whiz in so many cool ways, but it is also rooted in believable. All right, I believe we could have a holographic computer you could call up in front of your face. Sure, yeah, why not?
The plant thing might be a bridge too far for me.
Love it. Moving on. 1976 is Logan's Run. Now, I'm going to tell an anecdote about my history with this movie. Apparently, my parents loved it. And when I was a kid, we were allowed to stay up late, which I think meant 10 p.m. I'm not sure. But we were allowed to stay up late for stuff like, obviously, Wizard of Oz, Ten Commandments, Sound of Music. But every once in a while, there was a film that my mom or dad just liked, like The Frisco Kid with Gene Wilder and Harrison Ford. Obviously, being raised in a Jewish family, that was something we had to watch. But Jewish or not, I recommend that. It's a good comedy. And this was another one. This was, my parents liked this movie. So it's probably not appropriate for kids, but we definitely watched it on either network or UHF. Right. So most of the nastier stuff was cut. And when I saw it as a 20-something, the full uncut version, I was like, whoa, this movie's a bit sexier than I remember. Yeah. The movie is Logan's Run.
I don't know that I would call it sexier. It has more sex in it.
Act one. This film takes place in 2274, and society seems to live in a series of domes that were actually a mall in Texas. I wanted to look it up, but maybe Houston or Dallas. I'm not sure.
Probably Dallas.
Yeah, but this mall was turned into a sci-fi setting, and it's just dizzyingly campy, kitschy, old school, dorky. But I, as a kid, I was dazzled by this. I thought this was the most futuristic movie I'd ever seen. It's about a guy whose job it is to track down runners. Now, what are runners? Well, in this futuristic utopian society, everything is perfect, except when you hit 30 years of age, you go to a place called Carousel, you fly up into the air, and you die. You get zapped, and you get killed. Anybody over the age of 30 who is alive is tracked down by these guys, played by Michael York and Richard Jekyll, and their colleagues. They're like cops, and they chase down the runners and kill them, because nobody in this utopian society can live past the age of 30. And then why I wanted to pair these films together, and Stephen nailed it perfectly, is that they're both about relatively ignoble guys who suddenly find their humanity when they are forced to, because the system that they work for targets them. So Logan decides, because he falls in love with the wonderful Jenny Agutter from American Werewolf in London and the crush of millions of guys my age and girls, And he decides that he's going to run. He doesn't want to go to Carousel. And just like in Minority Report, his colleague, Richard Jekyll, takes off after him.
Is that really what happens, though?
Sorry?
I mean, it's just, well, so I, you know, getting into it a little bit, one of the questions that I had about this movie, and I have a whole long list of them, the inciting incident for him is not that he decides to run. It's that he is tasked with going undercover amongst the runners to try to figure out where they're going so that they can kill all the people.
Correct.
And so it was never clear to me from a character motivation standpoint when that switched for him or why. Because obviously by the end of the movie or midway through the movie, wherever it is, he has decided that he is going to become a runner and not just pretend to be a runner. But I have no idea when that moment happened or why or what caused it or what changed in him.
Because the computer, the dot in his wrist, he lost 4 years.
Right.
He still had more years to go, and they zapped him ahead as if to say, you're going to go on this mission, and now you're expendable. So that, I think I'm pretty sure that's the whole
thing. Is it? Because again, I felt like the first half of the movie, he was legitimately just a narc. He was, yep. You know, trying to figure out.
I liken it to a cop going undercover, and then the other cops don't know it, and they're just chasing him.
Yeah, yeah, right. And yeah. So it was not clear to me when that became no longer true, whether, you know, when he was no longer an undercover cop and when he actually switched from being an undercover cop to being a runner.
I have a lot of nostalgia for this movie. I think that a lot of the visual aspect of the film is hopelessly dated. I think some of the special effects were bad then and are very bad now. I think some of the special effects were decent then and bad now. And I think that the robot that shows up in Act 3 was terrible then and is terrible now. All right. I'm going to say that. I think when you try to do a completely futuristic world in very and all practical and miniatures and whatnot, you take a big swing. Yep. And I think some of the effects still hold up as admirable. But that bit with the ice and the robot, it was laughable as a kid. As a kid, my sister and I were like, dork, 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 dork. But yeah, I get the impression that, you know, warts and all, I still like the movie. And I get the impression that Steven does not. And I want to give him his full full swing at plate here.
All right. So my first time seeing this movie was this week. Obviously, I know that it exists. I know the basic premise. It's a very famous science fiction movie. But I'd never actually sat down to watch it. I don't think I'd seen a single frame of it prior to now. I didn't realize that Basil Exposition was the lead actor in it.
You made me laugh while I was smoking.
That's literally the only thing I know that actor from is Austin Powers.
Michael York has been in so much stuff. He's great.
I can't not. I can only see him as Basil Exposition throughout this entire movie. So that certainly was influencing my opinion of it. So my first time watching this movie was this week. It took me 3 sittings to get through the movie. I was bored to tears through almost all of it.
What bored you the most? Beginning, the middle, or the end?
The beginning, mostly.
Because honestly, Steven, you sitting down and watching a movie in 3 sittings, that's not uncommon. It could be a great
movie. It's not uncommon. No. But like this, you know, it's not uncommon usually because I only have a limited amount of time to actually sit down and watch something that I can't watch with the kid. But in this case, it was because I couldn't get through it. I had to turn it off and go do something else. The beginning especially. And it wasn't just the boredom. The problem was not so much the boredom. I found the characters spectacularly unengaging and the pacing to be, quote unquote, deliberate, especially during a lot of this opening stuff that felt like it was trying to go for this 2001, like contemplative sci-fi, slow sort of thing. You know, and then it picked up a little bit in the middle and then kind of got slow again towards the end. But my biggest problem with the movie was that I sat there with my brow furrowed the entire time because I had so many questions. So many questions. Beginning with...
Why 30?
Why would a movie that's supposed to be about youth, why would they cast a lead actor who looks like he's like maybe 3 or 4 years away from collecting Social Security? Why is everybody wearing the same 2 outfits and the same 2 colors? What is this carousel ritual? Why are they floating up to the ceiling? Are we supposed to see the wires that they're hanging by, or is that just because it was a bad special effect? Do these people have teleportation technology, and do they literally only use it for late-night booty calls, or are there other practical applications? At one scene, they terminate a runner remotely. They go, oh, look, there's a runner on the computer, and he pushes a button, and it kills the runner. Well, then what do they need the Sandman for? How did Logan figure out that no one had ever been renewed before? He just like says it at one point as he's talking to this computer. For that matter, what is this renewal they keep talking about? Are people supposed to be reborn into new baby bodies? Do they de-age somehow?
No, that's the lie. That's the lie.
I get that it's the lie, but like these people believe that it's true.
I think it's a knock on religion, honestly.
Right, but these people believe that it's true. You know, and given the fact that they're obviously lying about the whole thing, the powers that be in this world, why don't they just tell everyone that they get renewed? What's the point of this contest where only maybe a couple people get renewed? Speaking of which, who are the powers that be? Like, did somebody design this world this way? Did it evolve somehow? In either case, how did that come to be? Like I said, I wasn't sure why was Logan given this assignment to infiltrate the runners and find Sanctuary? Why had nobody been given this assignment before, considering that the computer seemed to know a whole lot about this supposedly secret society? And, you know, this Ankh symbol that she's wearing around her neck, the computer knew exactly what it was, and yet she's just wearing it around her neck, walking around. Why didn't the computer warn Sandman, hey, look out for people that are wearing the symbol, because they're probably runners and they're probably going to try to run when it's their time? You know,
I got one. That's a great litany of questions. I got one.
I'm only a third of the way through. So what's yours?
Why does the robot need food?
I think the robot was just programmed to stockpile food for its human masters, was my understanding.
Okay, go ahead. I want to hear more.
The better question is, why does the robot have lips and a tongue? why do they put violent delinquents in a prison until they turn 30 and then kill them instead of just killing them right away? Were there backwards voices talking in this prison? Why is there a 26-year-old dude playing a kid who's supposed to be 14? Again, in a movie that's supposed to be about youth and young people. How do people who grew up within 1 square mile of one another all have different accents? What good is changing your face? There's a whole sequence where they change his face. What is the point of changing your face if you have a blinking red light embedded in your palm telling everybody that you're supposed to be dead and that you're a runner? Wouldn't it make more sense to get the light changed instead of your face? How and why did the main characters suddenly find themselves in the middle of an orgy? And why is the orgy in slow motion? How bad of an actress is Farrah Fawcett?
Was
Farrah Fawcett. What is up? What's up with the guns that shoot fire and sparks? Are they, like, literally the dumbest weapon ever invented? And who fixes all the damage that they do to the walls? Because these guys are just shooting all over the place throughout this entire movie. And how has nobody ever accidentally burned the place to the ground before now? Hint, hint, foreshadowing. How and why does Logan go from being a narc to a true believer? So that's the one I already asked you. How gratuitous is it to have them take off their clothes to get warm and then put them back on again 5 minutes later? And why aren't the clothes frozen solid, given that they took their wet clothes and they stuck them down on ice? And then they literally just put them on as if, like, they dried while they were sitting there on the ice.
In the future, ice dries clothes. Everybody knows that. In her defense, I will say, Farrah Fawcett, in later films, like Extremities, She got better.
She got
early
better.
In this her career, but she was very, very stilted. But she got
She's
much better
terrible
later.
Terrible in this movie. Terrible.
Yeah, she is. I mean, but come on. If you were directing a young starlet like Farrah Fawcett because the studio told you to, you would work better to get a shot. You would work harder to make her look better.
Yeah.
Or you just. Yeah. I don't think that was a priority to make her look. And it's kind of a shame.
Yeah.
But she is a bit laughable in this, and it feels like stunt casting in every way.
Yeah.
Like, I do kind of love that, you know, the little side quest of him trying to get his face changed turns into a mini horror scene. I love that, but, you know.
But none of it makes any sense. It's so ridiculous. And then again, they just accidentally wander into an orgy.
I like the parallels. I like the parallels between the surgery scene in both
yeah.
movies.
Yeah,
that they both lead to horribly nasty side effects. Yep. And I think the main thing that really appealed to me as a kid, because a lot of the first third of the movie was trimmed down a bit when I was younger. I kind of like it, the whole quest thing. I like any movie, and I think you do too, you like a lot of movies, where characters are being chased, and they end up at one place, two place, three place, four place, and it's a long chase, like a road movie or a quest. And when they start on the run, and they end up at all these wild places, some places are fascinating and some are silly, and ultimately ending up in, you know, a super futuristic Washington, D.C., where they meet an old man who kind of remembers the old ways, and he's surrounded by cats. All that stuff just fascinated me. To me, this was as intelligent or as brilliant as Planet of the Apes or anything like that. It was that kind of level sci-fi as with adult eyes and with film critic eyes. Yeah, a lot of it has really clunky cardboard seams, and a lot of it is silly and should have been reshot or redone. And this is why I've always said that a remake could be such a good idea. It could address all the problems that you said. You focus on the young people by casting young people.
Jesus.
And a couple of years ago, it was close to happening with Nicholas Wendig Refn was going to direct with Ryan Gosling, and it completely fell apart. It completely died.
Again, Ryan Gosling is already too old. Like I love the premise of this movie. I think it's a fascinating idea. It made me want to read the book, because why they would change it from 21 to 30, it just blows. Like I guess there are practical reasons for doing that, because you can cast 20 somethings, but man, it's a terrible artistic choice.
Because I guess they thought we can sell Basil Exposition as 28, but we can't sell him as 16.
I guess right, but then there's maybe two or three kids under the age of like 15 in the entire movie. Like all of these guys, everybody, the extras, everybody, they all look like they're in their 40s. And then they finally meet an old dude at the end, like you said. You know, they go out and they hire a 55-year-old guy in bad old age makeup to play a 70, 80-year-old. I don't know how old he's supposed to be, but he clearly is not nearly as old as he actually is. And now I will say that I liked his performance. I thought he was one of the more interesting characters. You know, it was a little stagey, you know, for modern tastes.
Peter Ustinov.
I liked his performance a lot in that.
I just remember as a kid being so fascinated by her touching his face, because she had never seen an old person.
Yeah.
Now, I know that seems simplistic, but as a kid, that really sparked like, oh, she's never seen an old person.
Yeah, and that's an amazing, and you know, and think about how a society would function if the oldest people in it were 21. Think about the 21-year-olds that you know, or how you were when you were 21. Think about the jerks that you went to college with, you know? Think about your like frat boys who were the most senior people in a...
No, I was exactly the same as I am now as 21, but much, much more selfish.
You know, I didn't know my ass from a hole in the wall at 21. Nope. I would love to see a society that was built entirely, like where the most senior people were 21, but you know, the people who were considered sort of elders were 13 or 14 years old. Like that's a fascinating idea to me, and I would love to see that. I mean, that's a really, really tough thing to shoot, because you have to have a bunch of really, really good child actors. And, you know.
Well, the fact that you are able to at least admit that you love the basic idea and premise of the movie, because that is, I think in my heart, what speaks to me the most is that just these ideas, you know, not necessarily these weird sequences that don't feel connected, but just the whole idea of you shouldn't have to be targeted by the society for you to start caring.
Right.
You know, like those kind of themes are interesting. And then just the long quest, the interesting dynamic of his former buddy is now out to kill him because the system told him to.
Right.
And that's the difference between one and the other is, one hero. But the difference between a hero and a villain is the hero would probably ignore an evil system, whereas a lazier or more venal or selfish person would adhere to the system because it benefits him.
And again, all of that sounds great, and I would love to see that movie. I think this movie nods in the general direction of those things and expects you to sort of just take that as, okay, well, we're exploring these things. And it doesn't explore any of those things in any way that's not, you know, like ridiculously superficial, if that. And again, a big part of that is because, you know, the entire idea of this youth society is destroyed when you cast 35-year-old
right.
actors.
So you think that it's a cool premise kind of destroyed by the aesthetics and the business choice.
But also I think that I don't think the movie spent nearly enough time on helping us understand its characters. Understanding why were these guys, were they made sandmen? Did they decide to become sandmen? Did they have to train to do it? Was it an elite program where you have to apply and you have to get there? Or is it
hereditary?
Born Logan, right. Like, and that would be interesting to know, like, why do they believe in this system so fervently that they're willing to kill people? It's not a thing that's ever really sort of addressed. Like, why does Francis throughout this entire movie, he's so fervently, you know, like he literally leaves the facility in order to kill Logan, which clearly must not be a thing that they're supposed to do. But, you know, he is pursuing him maniacally, and I never get any sort of sense as to why. I don't understand why they kill everybody when they turn 30. Like, why don't they just let them leave? You know, like, all right.
What are your thoughts on the finale of how he, like, you know, how the when we talk about the savior myth or whatever, how he crashes the whole system and saves society?
Yeah, I mean, we get sort of close to the end of my questions here. Yeah. So then, why did Logan and Jessica go on the exact same tour of Washington, D.C. that my sixth grade class trip did? And why did we have to watch it in seemingly real time? That was the other part where the movie lost me.
Because they want to show off that. Oh, wait, but this is the part that I like. This is some of the, like, they just want to show you, look how, 300 years later, look how destroyed it is. That's all.
I get it. But, like, I got that when they showed up at the Lincoln Memorial. But then they didn't need to also walk past the Capitol and walk past the White House. They literally, like, went on a tour of D.C. And that's it fair. Took, like, 15 minutes of screen time. And it was just like,
that's
a good point. So then they find the old dude. Why does she just, like, this is such an old movie thing. She literally just stands there with her hand over her mouth looking shocked while Francis tries to kill Logan and doesn't do a thing to help him. She just watches. And Logan is, he's about to get his ass handed to him on the Senate floor and he's going to get killed. And she just kind of stands there going, oh no, oh gosh, oh no. And it's just, I'm glad that trope, I think, is dead.
Yeah.
I hope is dead. Yeah.
I mean, just pick up a rock.
Yeah.
I mean, come on.
But then, the finale, I wonder how this guy never noticed that there were these great domed cities on the horizon where he lives, because they clearly weren't that far away from the domes there in Washington.
I'm still not exactly sure how he destroys, Wikipedia says the computer overloads, but I'm not exactly sure how he makes it overload.
Why does the entire building explode from an errant one gunshot?
All right, there is no sanctuary. What he had found was old ruins exposed, an old man, and that the missing runners were, quote, all frozen.
Right.
These answers are not accepted by the computer, even after scanning Logan's mind, and the computer overloads, causing the city's systems to fail violently and release the exterior seals of the domes.
I didn't get that impression. I got the impression that he shot something and it blew up.
He just zapped
and
the
it caused no. And, well, no, but then it kind of caused it. It started causing a series of explosions. I thought finally these guns of theirs had did what they had been threatening to do all this time.
No. It's the old standby is if you tell the computer something contrary to what the computer knows, it makes the computer destroy itself.
Yeah, like, I didn't get that impression. I thought it was physical because they then get into this gunfight afterward and things start falling apart and domes start blowing up and everything explodes. And I thought it was just because of this gunfight that happened.
Okay, so what happens, let's say 1 year after the end of Logan's run? What happens? We have all a bunch of these old 31-year-olds and one old man.
We don't. We have a whole bunch of dead 31-year-olds. I mean, because none of these people could take care of themselves.
That's a great science question. If they lived inside of a dome system, there must have been a reason. Now the dome breaks down. How do you know, even inadvertently, they're not completely immune to viruses and diseases now?
Exactly. These people have never learned to take care of themselves. They don't know how to hunt. They don't know how to grow food. They don't know how to, they literally know nothing. They will all be dead in, 3 months, maybe, and then they'll turn on each other. They'll start killing each other.
Logan's Run 2 is just you panning across a landscape of dead corpses. That's literally it.
I mean, it's portrayed as this happy ending where they finally destroyed the system that's been oppressing them.
They're free!
But that system has also been feeding them and clothing them and giving them air conditioning and...
Oh, the poor humans of Logan's Run, including the gorgeous Jenny Agutter.
Nope.
All right, so nostalgia and current eyeballs included. Logan's Run is still a film that I enjoy, warts and clunkiness and dated effects and lazy writing and all. For entertainment value, I give it a B-. For science, I give it LOL.
I think you've invented a great new grade for the science.
We never talked about their tube system.
Whatever.
Do you at least appreciate the look like PBS level miniatures? Come on.
No.
It looked like someone had a giant train set and someone said, get that train set out of here. I need felt and we need a bunch of hamster wheels. And stop shaking the table. I'm trying to shoot this miniature.
In the opening scene, they show the dome from the outside, and there's supposedly grass or vegetation around them that's clearly just crumpled up newspaper painted green.
I'm still half impressed and half amused by the miniatures. Like the long shot that opens the movie. It's half of it is ambitious and impressive, and the rest of it is, dude, this was not top notch, man. So that's my take on Logan's Run. But can you can at least see why I wanted to pair these two together. That's good enough.
Yeah, I can see why you want to. And like I said, I think the premise is awesome. It makes me want to read the book because I really do think that the book probably explores a lot of these themes that the movie just completely and utterly just like is not interested in at all.
Good point. I love the movie and I've never read the book. And it is worth noting that like Minority Report, Logan's Run also inspired a short-lived TV series. Yep.
And yeah, I would love to remake this. I would love to see a remake of this done properly. And I hope that that happens. But this movie, as it exists, is C minus, D plus on the entertainment value. And it's a D probably on science. Although, you know what? I'm going to go with LOL as well, because who cares? Like,
fair
there
enough.
Are so many logic problems with this movie that I didn't even have a chance to focus on whether the science was made any sense or not. So,
thank you, Stephen. Thank you for everybody who's tuning in. We know you have many podcast options, and choosing us, we appreciate it. So until our next episode, thanks.
And if you would like bonus content from Scott's writing, as well as bonus episodes of the show, you can go to patreon.com/ScottEWeinberg and find those there. Thank you guys for listening, and we'll see you next week.